Welcome to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks old questions about new tech. We join you every month on the old-fashioned radio, or you can listen online as a podcast. Looks Like New is a production of the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. This month, our guest is Art Bramford, hosted by Julia Martins Rodriguez. Enjoy.
Welcome, listeners, to today's episode of Looks Like New. I'm Julia Martins, a research associate at University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm thrilled to welcome our distinguished guest, my colleague, Dr. Art Bramford. He's a lecturer in media studies at CU Boulder and a fellow at the Center for Media, Religion, and Culture. Dr. Bramford brings a fascinating perspective on the intersections of media, religion, and popular culture, particularly how American Christianism has shaped our media landscape. With the recent endorsement of Tesla by President Trump, we're seeing yet another example of how authority figures leverage publicity and how commercial entities benefit from these associations. This fascinating blend of politics, celebrity, and commerce is not new. It's deeply woven into American culture, which is precisely what Dr. Bramford's research illuminates. From religion's revivals to modern advertisement, from celebrity preachers to political influencers, the connection between authority and publicity has a rich and yet very complex history in America. Dr. Bramford, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you introduce your research and how you got into this?
Yeah, so I was interested kind of generally in Protestant Christianity in particular and its relationship with media, and then a little more specifically American sort of Christianity and its relationship with the emergence of like modern American advertising and public relations and marketing and sort of that. The culture that we have around, you know, those types of things. And so, yeah, so I've done a long kind of historical analysis going back to the beginning of the print revolution in Europe up through the 20th century, just kind of exploring that relationship between this particular group and, yeah, and how they've used media.
And I've watched recently, you made a presentation about an interesting comparison between the today's celebrity families like the Kardashians and the Beecher family of the 19th century. Could you tell us about the Beechers and how they might represent an early American case of fame and influence that foreshadowed our modern celebrity culture?
Yeah. So the way I became interested in them, in the Beecher family, was through one of the younger siblings, Henry Ward Beecher. And I came across, like I said, I was interested in the history of advertising, and I came across an ad for Pears soap, and it had a picture of Henry Ward Beecher and a kind of an endorsement from him, and he was what we would consider a megachurch pastor, so he was the church of the pastor of a large church in Brooklyn. It had like 3,000 members. His salary in today's money would be about $1.6 million. So he was very well paid, you know, both then and now. Yeah, so it was an ad for Pears soap, and it was one of the first sort of national advertising campaigns, and it was one of the earliest campaigns for a mass-produced sort of a consumer product, you know, like a bar of soap. And so that piece was interesting. It's also one of the first ads, if not the first ad, in a national campaign to use a kind of celebrity endorsement, you know, like they did with Henry Ward Beecher. And so, yeah, so I was kind of interested, you know, this is, like I said, one of the first ads to try to, you know, speak to a national audience for, you know, soap of all things. And the person they chose to be their, you know, spokesman was this megachurch pastor who also coincidentally had been involved in a major, very major sex scandal not too long before the ads started to run. And it was big enough that there were people that compared it to the Civil War in terms of how much publicity it got and how much newspaper coverage it got. So it was a very big scandal at the time. So yeah, so I became kind of interested in like why this person, you know, in an ad like this, why would he want to be in an advertisement like this, you know, as a church pastor? And it kind of led me to this family that he's a part of. So his dad was famous, you know, decades earlier, also kind of a religious leader, revival preacher. And then the dad, Lyman Beecher, had, I think, 12 kids overall, but there were 9 who were published authors. They were all known for different things, you know, and had kind of different causes and interests and stuff like that. And yeah, and so and I think two other siblings that kind of stood out to me were his sisters. So one of his sisters wrote a lot of very popular books about sort of how to be a housewife, but sort of framed it as this like empowerment kind of messaging that you know, that this was your way to contribute to the country and to solve, you know, they thought there were a lot of social problems kind of in the United States, and they said this is your way to contribute to solving, you know, all of these social problems, is to be a great wife and a great mother, you know, a great homemaker. So that was one of the sisters. And then probably the most famous family member was Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a very influential, you know, piece of sort of abolitionist literature. But really the whole family too was involved in the abolition movement, which was also, you know, an interesting facet of their kind of collective ideology. But the comparison with the Kardashians, I think, was because, you know, I started to look at this family and they all wrote different things and they were all unique in certain ways. But they also had a kind of consistent, you know, worldview, and a lot of their values were kind of similar, but they were sort of conveying those to different audiences. You know, so the sisters were writing kind of for one audience, and you had Harriet Beecher Stowe writing novels, you know, and that type of thing. Then you have Henry Ward Beecher, who's, like I said, the pastor of this church that has a lot of very wealthy people, you know, in New York City. But they basically, you know, they had very clear views about sort of gender, the role of family, that type of thing. A certain kind of domesticity, you know, they thought wives should kind of act a certain way in managing the household. And and views of wealth too, some kind of distinct views. So Henry Ward Beecher preached often that there was no reason why anyone should be poor. It's just a matter of working hard. And if you work hard, you know, then it won't be an issue. But yeah, so I thought it was interesting, you know, going from the advertisement of like, why would this person be in an ad for soap? And then kind of exploring the whole family and seeing this like consistent kind of brand, you know, that the Beecher family was a sort of brand that represented certain values.
And the soap seems kind of ironic considering followed the sex scandal.
Yeah, there's the whole interesting subtext of kind of purity stuff attached to soap kind of in the advertising history around soap. I have to imagine that the audience, you know, if you saw one of those ads, just thinking about how well publicized his scandal was, I have to assume that you would, you know, that would come to mind.
And soap was something people used to make at home, right, at that time. It was very unappealing product.
Yeah, it's an interesting one in the history of advertising because it's a very boring thing to try to sell. So a lot of the early ad agencies, it was kind of a challenge. It was like a unique challenge to get people, you know, to make it interesting just kind of in a general way. But it was also something that people, you know, they made their own soap at home. You know, and this was, they were trying to get people to buy a mass-produced sort of product. And it was something that people had no interest in going to the store and buying soap. And they were trying to kind of tell people how to use it as well. So there was stuff about, you know, washing your face every day and using it to kind of do certain things around the house. It's an interesting, in kind of the bigger history of advertising, soap has a very rich kind of history as a product.
And can you explain how religious revivals in particular created the foundation for modern advertising techniques?
Yeah. So revivalism is this interesting, it's a very kind of American phenomenon. So it's all this kind of religious activity that happens outside of churches. It's very populist kind of in nature. So they're trying to sort of speak to everybody and speak to the biggest possible audience. And it tends to kind of ebb and flow in terms of how active, you know, kind of revivalism gets at different times. But I think, you know, a kind of a real practical example that's interesting of sort of the influence in terms of technique and that type of thing is that one of the kind of tricks in a lot of revival sermons and a lot of their sort of literature that they would pass out is they had this sort of framing kind of rhetorical device where they would tell you, you know, if you continue down the path that of how you're living currently, you know, this is where it's going to lead. And they would sort of paint this picture of your life unraveling and falling apart and everything, you know, going horribly. And so they'd get you to this place where you're feeling very anxious and very uncomfortable and you're imagining your life, you know, going sideways. And then they'd say, or you can, you know, have this religious conversion experience and you'll go down this other path. And then they would, you know, give a vivid description of here's how your life could be if you make this other decision. And so that was kind of a tried and true, you know, thing that they used quite a bit. And it's interesting because with some of the early print advertising, it's very, very, very similar to the revival literature that they use that same sort of framing. But instead of the religious conversion being the kind of the hinge, it's buying the product, basically, and using the product. You know, so they say you can, if you don't use our product, your life is going to go very badly. And if you do, then it'll turn out great. And I think it's interesting because you still see that in some ads. And so I think like with pharmaceutical advertising, that still is a trick that they use, that they sort of show you the person who's sad and alone and suffering from some ailment or something, you know, and then it's like, try this, ask your doctor about our prescription drug. And then you see the person out, you know, living their best life with their friends and doing all kinds of fun stuff. But it's that same basic kind of idea of, you know, this is envision your life going to heaven and envision your life going to hell. And you're kind of at this crossroads and you have to pick which way you're going to go. Advertisers sort of picked that up and ran with it.
And that happened for soap as well with the Beecher. What was the message?
Yeah, so the soap ads definitely sort of played into that. The Beecher endorsement was kind of interesting. He used the John Wesley line that cleanliness is next to godliness. So kind of playing to that moral purity type of idea. And then just basically says he thinks it's the best soap. It's the best selling soap. He stakes his reputation on it, you know, that type of thing. So yeah, so they use that framing for sure, but a little, his endorsement was a little different.
And in terms of this divine aspect, how you mentioned that revival has conditioned Americans to see publicity and popularity as providential and almost divinely ordained. How do you see this playing out in today's celebrity culture and political landscape?
Yeah, so that was one of my kind of takeaways, I think, from researching this history. You know, there's this well-established kind of idea that there's an invisible hand that controls the market, sort of in the economic world. And I think there's, you know, again, particularly in American culture, there's this interesting kind of underlying idea that publicity works in a similar way. So if you're popular, it's for a reason. You know, it's part of some cosmic plan. You're supposed to be famous for some reason. You know, and even I think if people don't think that kind of explicitly, I think it's part of sort of how we understand celebrity, that they are these special kind of divined people, you know, for some reason. Yeah, and I think you still see that particularly with, you know, scandals and controversies and that sort of thing, and people's willingness to kind of let some of that stuff go, you know, or we sort of permit certain types of behavior with some celebrities that I don't think we would with non-celebrities.
And the connection between religious revival techniques and persuasive messaging is fascinating. And can you highlight some specific revival techniques that were later adopted by the advertising industry?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned the kind of the choice framing, you know, of choosing sort of option A is going to take your life in this direction, option B will take it in this other direction. And that was one of the really big ones, I think, and one of the more obvious ones. Another one that comes to mind, there's a very famous guy named Charles Finney, who actually wrote a lot of books and did lectures and stuff on how to do revivalism, kind of. And so he had been very successful at it, and so he started telling other people, here's how to get other people to convert, kind of a thing. But one of the things he talked about was using little stories, basically. And it's interesting because he actually looks at the Bible and he says, you know, Jesus had these little parables that he used to kind of illustrate his points and stuff like that. And so he says, you know, come up with these little sort of slice of life, you know, moments and these kind of little vignettes where, you know, you can make a moral kind of a point or teach a little lesson or something like that. But it's such kind of the style of a lot of advertising, you know, of these little, again, you know, the kind of slice of life scenes of domestic life or something like that. You know, and so the one example Finney uses is he says, you know, imagine a woman goes to the butcher and she wants to buy two steaks, and she gets home and realizes that she only paid for one. So she goes back to the butcher and says, I'm sorry, you only charged me for one. And then he's so moved by her honesty, you know, that he says, oh, I'll give you the second one for free. You know, and it has this impact on him that, you know, he's so impressed by her and stuff like that. You know, so those, like, those little kind of stories, that became a big part of it. And I feel like it's also maybe useful to say that one of the kind of controversial things with Finney's style is that he used kind of like the second person. So when he addressed his audience, he would say like you or you all and that type of thing. And that was like not something people did, just in terms of how formal the discourse was. And I always thought that's interesting as well, that, you know, to kind of shift to a lot more informal kind of a register. So
communicating, giving that feeling of familiarity with the celebrity, with that product, with whoever is communicating with the audience. It's interesting. And in your work, you suggest that the Civil War created this vacuum that allowed advertising to assume revivalism's culture role. And could you elaborate on this transition and its significance?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about revivalism, and I mentioned that it kind of ebbs and flows. So there are times where it'll get more active, where there's more of this kind of stuff going on. But when people have kind of looked back and analyzed it, one of the sort of cultural functions that it has had is that it would, you know, a lot of times there'd be a lot of things changing in the culture, and, you know, particularly the economy with things like the Industrial Revolution. And so one of the interesting things that revivals did is that it sort of helped people if they were at a lower socioeconomic status and they were moving up that sort of ladder. It became this kind of pathway to do that, that it would help kind of, you know, lead you up into the middle class, kind of a thing. And then the same too, that it also helped people that were going down the socioeconomic ladder to kind of come to terms with that and adjust to it in certain ways. So it had this unique, you know, role of sort of establishing what the kind of American middle class culture sort of looked like and felt like, you know, and also just kind of giving people a vision of, you know, what it means to kind of flourish in your life in a general sense, you know, painting a picture of these are, you know, the kinds of goals and aspirations that you should have and some of those kinds of things. But then, interestingly, kind of leading up to the Civil War, there was a lot of religious discourse around the issue of slavery and kind of theological arguments, you know, for and against it. And the culture was much more, there was a lot more of that back then. It was much more a part of kind of, you know, popular culture. And at one point I compared it in some of my work to like professional sports today. You know, that if you talk to real diehard sports fans, they know a lot, you know, they have this kind of real grasp of all the ins and outs of it and that kind of thing. And there were a lot of people who were like that with theological stuff. But so there's this kind of big theological debate that sort of leads into the Civil War. And then the war itself was really brutal in a lot of ways. And so the effect of that after the Civil War is that there's this kind of, and this is what I described as sort of a vacuum, is that there's this kind of retreat of religion out of the popular culture to a certain extent. And so that's where I think advertising is able to come in and do the sort of cultural work that I mentioned of establishing this is what the middle class looks like and feels like, you know, and sort of helping as people climb the socioeconomic ladder, helping them acclimate to that, and yeah, and giving people a kind of a vision of what it means to flourish in their lives.
And how do you see this legacy of Protestant revivalism manifest in today's digital media environment, particularly in how brands and influencers, digital creators, engage with their audiences?
Yeah, I think the one of the people that comes to mind a lot is there's a revivalist in the colonial era named George Whitefield, who's just a really interesting guy. It's been estimated that more people heard and saw him speak sort of live in person than any other human being prior to the invention of like amplification. And there's actually a funny story in Ben Franklin's autobiography about trying to figure out how to measure how loud George Whitefield was, because he could preach to these big crowds. But they estimate that he could preach to a crowd of about 20,000 people without any microphone, which is insane. You know, so he was this very celebrated sort of preacher, and he traveled around constantly. He's just like always on the move. It's kind of very impressive to read his, you know, travel history. But so he's going around doing all these speaking engagements. But then as he's doing that, he also wrote a lot of personal letters and kept in correspondence with people. And a lot of those things would get republished in the newspaper, so it would kind of, you know, get shared with the public that way. And then one of his popular publications is that he had this series called his journals, which is exactly what it sounds like. And a lot of that was more about his sort of travel adventures than it was, you know, any kind of religious content. And so you get the idea that, you know, and like I said, he's traveling and he would do these kind of circuits where he'd hit the same, you know, if you lived in Philadelphia, he'd be there every, you know, 9 months or something like that. But you kind of get the idea that like people would, you know, you'd hear about this guy and you'd go hear him speak and it would be this huge event, this kind of moment in the city. There'd be all this stuff published afterwards that people don't agree with him, or they do, or they like him, or they don't. You know, and then you would read his journals, you'd read his correspondence with people, you know, and so you can imagine that there's this very similar kind of relationship that people would develop to our sort of social media, you know, figures today and influencers today, in terms of that like parasocial kind of relationship, of feeling a sort of closeness, you know, with these public figures. But yeah, and I thought, you know, so to see that in the 1700s, I thought was really interesting, and not something I expected. For sure. So another example that I've looked at is a woman named Amy Semple McPherson, who's another very interesting character. But she's in Los Angeles in kind of the early, like 1930s-ish. And she's she's actually the first woman to have a broadcasting license. And so she does a lot of radio stuff. But the interesting thing with her is that I think, you know, there were a lot of religious figures trying to get into radio somehow. They kind of recognized that it had some potential. But I think a lot of them sort of thought about it as, you know, as if it was just text. So, you know, it's like, it's just a way to transmit words to people kind of a thing. You know, and so you'd get a lot of people that would just sort of read their, you know, sermon over the radio and that type of thing. But Amy is really interesting because she really thought about sort of the emotion, the experience, that kind of thing. You know, so she would invite her radio audience to come over and put their hand on the radio to sort of feel the, you know, the spiritual power that was coming through the radio. And, you know, and even some of the like production kind of flourishes. So she had, you know, she'd have more, she'd have her sort of audience mic'd a little more than most people, so you could hear their reactions to stuff. You know, so she would have laughs, you know, behind her jokes, and some of those types of things. And then when they did baptisms, she put a microphone right next to the water, so you'd kind of get the, you know, the water sounds and that type of thing. But really interesting because she just, like I said, thought about making it a more kind of visceral, you know, emotional experience where you feel like you're participating in something and you're connected to something. And yeah, I thought that was a unique way of kind of approaching it back then.
What was the term did you use to describe it? This sense of proximity? Parasocial?
Oh, the parasocial. Yeah, parasocial relationships. Yeah, I think just creating that sense of kind of closeness with the public figure, the celebrity, that type of thing.
And this is probably the main strategy used by a lot of the influencers today and creators, is to create that parasocial approach and strategy and create that sense of proximity, even though we're talking about millions of followers. Some of the most followed, most famous celebrities online, they record their routine, every bit of their routine, what time that is happening, showing their families, showing their business meetings and everything, basically, and creating that sense of people know what's going on in their lives, people know them, people know their aspirations, and create that sense of familiarity. And that's why I imagine it's so easy to pursue people to buy the products they're advertising, because they blend in their routine, those products. And a lot with the strategy mentioned earlier of identifying a problem, your hair is extra dry and you have split ends. Well, this is what you need to do. You need to buy this supplement, this hair supplement, to improve your hair health. And trust me, I've been using, I can endorse this product. It's part of my routine, and that's why it's so successful and people buy it.
Yeah, and it's funny because that format is, we call that a testimonial. And that's very much a kind of a religious paradigm, you know, that type of communication. And so that actually, in the first kind of big wave of revivalism in the U.S., there's these people, you know, there was a lot of like letter writing, kind of an amazing amount of just people wrote letters to each other constantly. They didn't have text messaging, I guess. But that was, you know, a lot of the letters were these kind of testimonials of, here's what my experience has been, which included people like George Whitefield, you know, of saying, here's my experience of seeing him speak. But it was to the point where they created this sort of holiday, this like recurring holiday, where they would go to church and somebody would get up and just like read the mail and like read some of the best letters that they had gotten from different people. But yeah, it's funny to think, because that the testimonial format is part of that.
And it's curious that sometimes the creators, they even add, like, I wouldn't be advertising this if I was not using, you know, I'm loyal to my followers, I would only recommend the things I use, and I know it's good, and they will endorse that as, like, something very legitimate. Maybe in some case it is, but that type of testimonial is key to make people believe that product is different and better than others in the market and stand out because of that authority that is tied to yeah. Advertising.
Yeah, and that's the Henry Ward Beecher, you know, soap ad that we kind of started out talking about. That's the end of his little blurb endorsing the soap, is he basically says, you know, I put my reputation behind this, like, you know, that's how seriously I'm recommending this particular bar of soap. But that was part of what was interesting to me, was, you know, this figure that has, well, like I said, the kind of the family notoriety on the one hand, and a little bit of infamy for the kind of the sex scandal that he was a part of. But he still had that like moral kind of authority. And I don't know if it's quite authenticity, but, you know, to kind of put that out there in the service of selling soap, I thought was interesting.
And was that imprinted on the package?
It was in the ads, yeah.
In the ads.
Where he was featured. They had a little portrait of him with his blurb, yeah.
Very interesting. And as someone who has written about navigating digital spaces, particularly for young people, how do you see the historical patterns you've studied playing out in adolescent identity formation online today?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things, and it comes up a lot, I think, throughout media history when there's new forms of media, and I sort of, I think, referenced this a minute ago, but the idea of sort of what's public versus what's private, that always is sort of called into question. It's kind of renegotiated a little bit of, like, what do we want to share publicly? What do we not want to share? You know, and an interesting thing going back to radio, in the history of radio, is that when it first was being developed, there was a lot of resistance to having any advertising on the radio because they thought people would listen to it in their homes, and they thought that your home was a kind of safe space from commerce and business.
And should be.
Yeah, and it'd be nice, yeah, if we can go back to that. You know, but they had this clear sense of, like, that's a private space and you don't do business in your home, you know, and they thought advertising was business. And so, you know, they wanted to keep that real kind of clean separation. But that's the kind of thing that you see, you know, like with the letter writing, you know, going back a little further, I mentioned that your private correspondence would end up in the newspaper sometimes. But it's something that always kind of gets reconfigured and renegotiated. And I think that's an interesting part of, like, the influencer culture as well. You know, and specifically, you know, I've seen some things about sort of parents using their kids as influencers, which is a whole other, you know, kind of range of issues we could get into. You know, but I think we are in another one of these kind of interesting periods where we're sort of renegotiating what's private, what's public, where do we sort of draw those lines, and some of those questions. So I think that's one of the more interesting areas for me.
Especially when the lines are very blurred. And one thing that stands out since I've moved to the U.S., I'm from Brazil, the type of regulation around advertising for kids on TV and very limiting the ability of companies to be speaking directly to the kids, buy this toy, buy this game. And the same with pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical drugs. But the lines, even on TV here, seem to be way more flexible. But when we looked online, then we miss completely those lines. And kids are exposed to the testimonials, the authorities, all those techniques. They're designed to influence us, and they do successfully. And I just imagine the effect on young minds. They're still understanding how to identify those techniques and don't feel so vulnerable to the consumption culture that they encounter online.
Yeah. Some of my other kind of research has been, I've done a lot of interviews with parents about kind of getting, you know, adopting digital media, adapting to it kind of in the household and trying to figure out how to do that as they raise their kids. You know, not having a kind of example or role model, you know, from their own experience to go off of. But that's one of the things that's been kind of amazing to me, is that I think there's an assumption with a lot of parents that if it says it's for kids, somebody is making sure that it's appropriate for kids. And that isn't really the case with a lot of the stuff. And it's not so much the kind of what we would consider, like, blatantly, you know, explicitly inappropriate, you know, so it's not sex and violence and some of those kinds of things. But I think especially in this area of the consumerism piece of it, you know, and there's one of the more interesting issues that's come up is kind of the media literacy piece of, when is a kid old enough to know that an ad is an ad? You know what I mean? That this is not entertainment the way that the, you know, what's the dog, Bluey or yeah, whoever. You know, that's entertainment, and that is somebody telling you a story, but this other thing is somebody trying to either sell you something or sell your parents something. You know, and with some of the older kind of regulations and guidelines and stuff, they tried a little bit to make that more clear. And I think that's it's an interesting kind of challenge to think about, of where, how old, you know, are kids when they can kind of figure out that distinction. And I always, thinking about this stuff, I always kind of go back to Mr. Rogers, which I realize is a very dated reference, but there's been some good documentaries and movies about him lately. But he had such a good sense of that sense of relationship, you know, that he talked a lot about kind of forming this relationship with kids, and he talked to them as sort of peers. And, you know, again, that parasocial relationship idea, that I think he took that really seriously. And kind of showed that it can be used, you know, that all different types of media can be used, you know, in a much more positive way to help kids kind of deal with reality a little bit, as opposed to just constantly trying to sell them stuff. So
fascinating. And can you let us know what you've been currently working on, where you see your work leading to?
Yeah, so a lot of my recent work has been this kind of long history of Protestantism, like I said, and kind of their relationship with media, how that's influenced the development of advertising, and so kind of combining those histories a little bit. But there's so many things kind of all along the way and sort of throughout that history that I've wanted to get into more and to kind of revisit more. So like the Beecher family and Henry Ward Beecher and that whole thing, you know, it in my sort of dissertation project, it got a little bit of coverage, but there's lots of different kind of these sort of side tangents and things that I would love to explore. And then I think, you know, I'm always sort of trying to think through some of, you know, like, what are the implications of this for us today? What does it help us to understand better about kind of our current media landscape? And yeah, and if there's lessons that we might learn from some of these things as well.
Absolutely, especially to realize so many things we witness firsthand and on social media today, and they feel new, they have, you know, they're just an innovation that came with social media, but they realize the deep roots, deep in the past, drawback centuries, and has been used for just in a different medium, just in a different context, but it's as effective today as it was 200 years ago, and, you know, 100 years ago at least, and it's interesting to find, to understand those roots, and also to, for people to start paying attention in those techniques, right, especially in the political environment we are experiencing, is to understand when we see it, we know what what we are seeing, and what that means, and why things are being presented in a certain way and packaged around certain techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And just one, I was thinking of one kind of example as you were talking, but one of the people I looked at was John Calvin, who's a theologian in like the 1500s in Switzerland. But one of the funny things, and this is the type of stuff that I would love to get into more, but he essentially had groupies. So he had people that came from all over Europe to hear him preach a sermon. And then he would travel around and preach in different churches throughout the city of Geneva, where he lived. People would try to figure out where he was going to be, and then they would tell their group, you know, and they'd all kind of follow him like, you know, Grateful Dead fans or whatever, like all around the city of Geneva. And then he didn't write down his sermons because he wanted that to be more kind of extemporaneous. And so his groupies started hiring people to transcribe sort of like these bootleg copies of his sermons. But, there, you know, that kind of stuff, it's like you would never expect, you know, that's very sort of fan kind of pop culture behavior. So it's really interesting to see that with somebody that we tend to think is this kind of, you know, ivory tower theologian that didn't have groupies chasing after him. So,
and we do that with politicians and so many other people that, you know, we need to be cautious that we want to have that fan behavior or be, you know, critical and sound-minded to approach that parasocial relationship with these figures.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Art. This was very insightful. I really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks old questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us every month on the air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month.